All right. Hitler's War by David Irving. Correcting the Front Line. No month brought such concentrated high drama as July 1943. Citadel began. The enemy invaded Italian soil. The Russians sprang their own great summer offensive. Mussolini was ousted by his monarch, just as Hitler had always predicted, and the war in the air reached a climax in pre-nuclear barbarism. Until the end of June, Hitler had waited at the Berghof, watching events in Italy, fearing to trigger Citadel, the battle for Kursk, in case Mussolini's generals staged a mass defection while his back was turned. On the 16th, General Guderian had come up and explained why his tank output estimates had proved over-optimistic. Oops, lost my spot. Oh, there we are. He now suggested that the Panther tank should not be put into action until at least 500 were available. Zietzler proposed staying their own hand until the Russians had pushed out westward themselves, and then launching a counterattack. Tactically, it was an attractive idea, but Hitler's objection was that Stalin had no reason to oblige him by attacking before events on the Mediterranean front compelled Germany to send divisions there, and this objection could not be faulted. On June 18th, after a fresh conference with Zietzler and Guderian, Hitler committed himself to the offensive solution and, upon reasoned objections stated by General Model on June 25th, finally postponed it until July 5th. Kluge and Manstein approved the decision. Yet Hitler clearly anticipated failure, for he forbade the OKW to proclaim Citadel publicly, so that he could deny its existence if he was cheated of success. When Goebbels drove up to the Obersalzberg on June 24th, Hitler had lengthily justified his strategic thinking to him. His armies could not contemplate advancing on the Urals. Despite the superior quality of the new Tiger and Panther battle tanks, he had decided to sit tight and conserve strength until 1944 to render the Eastern Front impregnable to winter crises like those of the past 2 years. He regarded the imminent operation only as a, quote, minor correction, unquote, of the line, which might well rob Stalin of a few armies or even an army group, but which would hardly swing neutral world opinion to a view of Germany as victor again. In the Mediterranean, he said, he expected the Allies to assail Sardinia first, and then lunged toward the Peloponnese. Quote, "The Führer believes he can hold this line," wrote Goebbels the next day. "Under no circumstances will he fall back from the Italian mainland. He has no intention of falling back on the Po River, even if the Italians do defect. In that case, the war in Italy will just have to be fought by us alone," end quote. The Duce himself was old and worn out, said Hitler, and his people were limp and listless. This was why he was determined not to become too powerfully engaged in Russia. It would hamstring him if Italy collapsed. In the general government of Poland, Hans Frank and his provincial governors complained that it was Himmler's own doctrinaire policies that contributed most to the unrest. Meanwhile, the SS rampaged regardless of Frank's political authority, simply terrorizing and intimidating. Himmler's forced resettlement programs in the Lublin district, the whole villages being expelled overnight and repopulated with bemused German peasants, resulted in the indignant resignation of Frank's governor at Lublin. Frank took his complaints personally to Hitler early in May 1943, but Hitler told him his problems were nothing to those of the occupied eastern territories. Hitler's chagrin at the lengthy April ghetto uprising in Warsaw was so great that he would dearly have liked to replace Frank by a tougher viceroy. But by whom? For 2 hours, he debated with Bormann, Ley, and Goebbels, the party's debilitating lack of first-class leadership material. And I lost my spot. Okay, eventually he decided that Hans Frank must stay. Frank could not help his failure. Hitler admitted, the job was beyond anybody's ability. Quote, he has to extract food supplies, prevent the unification of his people, ship out the Jews, and yet at the same time accommodate the Jews from the Reich. He has to step up arms production, refrain from rebuilding the ruined states, and so on. End quote. Yeah, it's a lot of work. After a four-hour walk with Reichsfuhrer Himmler on the Obersalzberg on June 19th, Hitler endorsed the SS position. No blame was to be attached to the SS for the current increase in partisan activity in Poland or elsewhere. Hitler noted that, or not him, not Hitler, Himmler noted that day, quote, "When we discussed the Jewish problem, the Führer spoke in favor of the radical completion of the evacuation of the Jews, despite the unrest this will still cause over the next 3 or 4 months. That will just have to be put up with," end quote. The Jewish problem was taboo at the Berghof. A few days after Himmler's visit, Balder von Schirach and his pretty wife Henriette were in Hitler's house party. They joined the fireside circle, slumped in deep armchairs in the semi-darkness. While Hitler sipped his special tea and the others their wine or cognac, Henriette exclaimed that she had just witnessed at Amsterdam the loading of Jews into open trucks for deportation. Quote, "Do you know about it?" she asked. "Do you permit it?" End quote. Hitler retorted, quote, "They are being driven off to work, so you needn't pity them. Meantime, our soldiers are fighting and dying on the battlefields," end quote. He later added, "Let me tell you something," quote, quote, "Let me tell you something. This is a set of scales," and he put up a hand on each side like the pans. "Germany has lost 500,000 of her finest manhood on the battlefield. Am I to preserve and minister to these others? I want something of our race to survive 1,000 years from now." He reproached her, "You must learn how to hate," end quote. The Schirachs were still there the next evening, June 24th, when Goebbels wickedly brought the fireside conversation around to Vienna. Until after 4 a.m., Hitler drew savage comparisons between Schirach's Viennese and Goebbels' Berliners until tears welled up in Henriette's eyes. The Berliners, he said, were hard-working, intelligent, and politically shrewd. Goebbels wrote, quote, "Frau von Schirach in particular acted like a silly cow, and later summed up her unhappiness by saying that she wanted to go back to Munich with her husband, and would the Führer send Galater Giesler to Vienna instead," end quote. Quote, "Tell me," Hitler challenged her, "is your husband our Reich representative in Vienna, or is he Vienna's man in the Reich?" End quote. The Schirachs departed in a huff the same night and never saw Hitler again. In the Ruhr town of Wuppertal, 3,000 civilians had been killed by the British bombers in half an hour that night. Hitler decided to deliver a fresh homily to Goering the next day. As Goebbels put it in his journal, the Reichsmarshal's stock had now hit rock bottom. Goering knew it too, and anxiously jotted down in his own diary a number of things he intended to say in justification to Hitler. Quote, "Situation in the south, in the southeast, in the north, my own position as commander-in-chief, Jeschenik on leave, Milch, Udet, controversy, my own activities, stenographic record produce my appointment diary, influencing subordinates, consulting with them, troops' confidence in me, worst will be over this autumn. Inspection visits by me. Examples, Vienna aeroplane engine works. My present task, overhauling the Air Force. Clear technological objectives. Revive flagging spirits." End quote. The bombing war had become a nightmare for Hitler. Albeit the ravaging of these ugly Ruhr conurbations did not distress him overmuch. One day, he predicted, Germany would have 10 million Volkswagens and 5 million other cars to contend with, and these towns would have had to be rebuilt with broader boulevards anyway. But Speer was having to divert 100,000 men to repair the Ruhr, and the people's morale was brittle. Hitler promised to make an early surprise visit to the Ruhr. At present, every German bomber was needed for, quote, no, a citadel. I was going to quote citadel, the name of the operation again. Was needed for Citadel and Italy, he told Goebbels, and that he had ordered the anti-aircraft and night fighter defenses increased. One fighter armed with the new 30mm cannon had recently shot down 5 bombers in a single night. His forbearance with Goering was truly monumental. He feared to hurt his feelings, but without Goering's knowledge, he did invite the leading aircraft manufacturers to see him. He wanted to find out the truth about production failures. Professor Ernst Haeckel excused his failure to produce a satisfactory heavy bomber by citing Goering's persistent demand that a Haeckel 177 be a dive bomber, although Goering had forbidden precisely that use 10 months earlier. And when Hitler questioned Professor Willy Messerschmitt about the new ME-262 jet aircraft, the brilliant but self-centered aircraft designer pointed out that the jet's aircraft's fuel consumption would be far higher than his beloved project, the ME-209, and thus secured a Führer order reversing Milch's earlier decision to mass-produce the ME-262. At midday on June 29, 1943, Hitler decided to transfer his headquarters back to the Wolf's Lair. He believed Citadel could safely begin 6 days later and on schedule. There seemed to be clear proof that Stalin was apprehensive about the outcome of Citadel. On June 21st, the German envoy in Stockholm cabled that the Soviet diplomatist A.M. Alexandrov, quote, wants to meet with a gentleman from the German Foreign Service with whom he is acquainted, end quote. And on July 1st, a Soviet magazine article derided the, quote, collective guilt, unquote, theory propagated by the West against Germany and hinted that the Reich might even keep Poland and the Sudeten territories. Hitler arrived back at the Wolf's Lair on June 1st. It was unseasonably cold here, and Morel gave him a stiffer-than-usual cocktail of glucose, multivitamins, and tonophosphan injections. That same evening, Hitler addressed his Citadel commanders assembled at Zeitzler's nearby HQ. He explained to them why he had kept postponing Citadel. He now had 2,000 tanks ready for battle, although admittedly half were only the older Mark III. Quote, in a grave, clear, and confident voice, he made the following points, recorded General Friesner. End quote. Quote, The blame for our misfortunes must be laid squarely on our allies. The Italians let us down completely. If, as the Führer repeatedly demanded, they had made timely use of their fleet to escort and transport their troops to Africa, Africa would not have been lost. Now their ships are being smashed in their harbors. Comparison with World War One, where we too conserved our fleet too long until it was too late. Italians failed on the Eastern Front, in Greece, etc. Hungary likewise. Romania, unreliable. The Marshal's brother, Prime Minister Mihai Antonescu, is a devious character. Finland, at the end of her tether, internal troubles with social democrats, fostered and fed by Sweden. What's at stake? Germany needs the conquered territory, or she will not exist for long. She must win hegemony over Europe, where we are, we stay. Soldiers must see this, otherwise they'll regard their sacrifices as in vain. Balkans must not be lost, whatever happens. Our most vital and raw materials are there. The Italians have pulled out of Greece and been replaced by Germans. Feel safer since then. Crete is firmly in our hands. Thus we prevent enemy from getting air bases. Greater Germany and Europe must be defended far beyond our frontiers. So far, we have managed this perfectly. German troops are now occupying the Isle of Rhodes, Sicily, Sardinia, and Corsica. The Italians would have long surrendered them, just as they did without fighting in Pantelleria. Eastern Front. We will yield nothing without a scrap. The Russians are biding their time. They are using their time replenishing for the winter. We must not allow that, or there will be fresh crises for this winter. So, we've got to disrupt them. And that's the end of the quote. The last sentence indicates how limited Citadel's objective was. Hitler concluded, quote, the die has been cast. The attack is on. Everything must now be done to ensure its success, end quote. The operation itself was barely discussed. General Model repeated his misgivings. Goering and Manstein shared the general optimism about Citadel. Only Jodl did not, fearing that a long, drawn-out battle lay before them. But Hitler reassured his generals. Of course, the attack was a risk, he admitted, but he felt it had to be taken. In his words, Citadel had to procure a victory to, quote, dispel the gloom of our allies and crush any silent hopes still stirring within our subjugated people's breasts, end quote. Citadel began early on July 5th. The Russians had been forewarned, once again thanks to Britain's code-breaking. An immense and bloody battle ensued, one of the greatest tank battles in history. Longing for a word of great victories, Hitler telephoned Zietzler and Jeschenik repeatedly for the latest news. By evening, it seemed that the battle was going well. General Desselux and General Robert Ritter von Grimm's combined air forces, the 4th and 6th, had flown 4,570 sorties, destroying 432 Russian planes. Manstein had plunged 11 miles northward into enemy fortifications. Kluge had come 7 miles south toward him. Between their spearheads lay the city of Kursk and 3,000 tanks which Stalin had thrown into the defense. Morel checked Hitler early on the 6th and wrote in his diary, quote, "Injections as always. Slept only 3 hours because of his nervousness, attacking on the Eastern Front since yesterday." End quote. The physician ordered Hitler to get as much sleep as possible in the afternoons. The familiar euphoria gripped the wolf's lair. In the first 3 days, there were 30,000 German casualties, but Zietzler could report that tank losses were at an acceptable level. By the 8th, 460 enemy tanks had been destroyed. Hoth's 4th Panzer Army knocked out 195 that day alone. But in the south, the technical inadequacy of the much-vaunted Panther battle tank hampered Manstein's offensive badly. On the first day alone, all but 40 broke down. Nonetheless, while in the north, Model's 9th Army found it could penetrate no farther. Little now lay ahead of Manstein in the south. Rommel noted in his diary on July 9th, quote, "Noon, at war conference with Führer. Attack in the east is going well." End quote. That afternoon, Hitler received the first reports that a large enemy invasion operation was underway in the Mediterranean. Luftwaffe aircraft sighted the ships after they sailed from Malta and Pantelleria. By late evening, it was clear they were heading for Sicily. There were reports of enemy paratroop landings and a heavy naval bombardment of the island's main harbors at Syracuse, Catania, and Augusta. The next morning, the invasion began. Hitler was told at his noon conference that 300 ships were involved. This could not have come at a less propitious moment for Hitler's strategy. The most disturbing accounts of the Italian officers' actions reached Hitler. Admiral Priam Leonardi, the commandant of Augusta, falsely reported that on July 11th, enemy assault craft had landed there. The Italian defenders at once blew up their guns and ammunition and set fire to their fuel dumps. The anti-aircraft batteries at Augusta and Priolo fired their entire ammunition into the sea and blew up their guns as well. Quote, "On the afternoon of July 11th, there was not one Italian soldier left in Schmalz's brigade area under any kind of command. Every single officer had abandoned his troops during the morning and was heading for Catania on bicycles and motor transport." End quote. Jesus fuck. By July 12th, the enemy had landed 160,000 men and 600 tanks on Sicily. On that day, Stalin launched his own counteroffensives. Why did Hitler's continued buoyancy remain undiminished even now? He felt that even if Citadel were now called off, it would still have drawn the Soviet dragon's teeth. Manstein alone counted 24,000 prisoners by July 13th, and he had also captured or destroyed 1,800 enemy tanks, 762 artillery pieces, and 1,080 anti-tank guns. In Hitler's view, Stalin had had no option but to counterattack now, because famine and unrest were sweeping his country. This was well supported by Zietzler's intelligence experts, who had sorted through hundreds of bags of captured Russian mail. There were comparisons with the disastrous Soviet famine of 1921. Above all, Hitler now had the prospect of new German secret weapons to sustain him. On July 8th, Dönitz came with the blueprints of the new Type 21 submarine, diesel-electric, with an underwater speed so high it would frustrate all the enemy's defensive tactics. His experts hoped the first such boats would be ready by November 1944. Dönitz hoped to fit out all his U-boats soon with a simple device that would give them ample warning that the radar set was homing onto them. A new anti-shipping mine had been developed, so potent and so difficult to combat that, for the present, Hitler would not even allow his navy to employ it for fear the enemy would capture one and use the device in far greater numbers against Germany. As Speer came in, Hitler turned to him. Quote, "The most vital thing is to build this new U-boat," end quote, Speer replied. Quote, "We all agree on that. We have already ordered that it is to take priority over everything else," end quote. That same day, Speer brought him the top scientists of the Army's Rocket Missile Research Laboratory at Peenemünde. Hitler had been cool toward the Army's A4 rocket project, but Brauchitsch had bracketed the A4 project, and General Friedrich Fromm, a commander of the replacement army, had been a dedicated benefactor. He had shown Speer over Peenemünde in June 1942, and the new minister had lent it his authority. Hitler had told Speer some months later that the A4 would be pointless unless 5,000 were available for the first salvo, and production ran at the rate of 3,000 a month. The problem was that each rocket had only a 1-ton warhead, yet cost as much as 100 of the pilotless flying bombs being built by the Luftwaffe. It was fueled by such exotic substances as liquid oxygen and pure alcohol, and the aluminium, and electronics equipment were needed far more urgently for the Luftwaffe's industry. But Speer turned a blind eye on this, for he was not, after all, accountable for the aircraft industry as yet. On July 8th, he introduced to Hitler the men behind the A4 project: Gerhard Degenkolb, the man who was to mass-produce the rockets, General Walter Dornberger, a commandant of Peenemünde, and the young chief scientist, Werner von Braun. Hitler watched their film of the rocket and promoted Braun to professor on the spot. Both the Army and the Luftwaffe assured him that their missiles would be operational against England before the year was out. 2 days later, Heinrich Himmler came to the Wolf's Lair. The A4 rocket was at the top of his agenda. Himmler never disappointed Hitler, let alone bored him. Today, the Reichsfuhrer wanted to advocate turning the Polish underground army against Stalin. The Poles were bitterly disillusioned that Churchill had torn up Chamberlain's guarantee to Poland. And when the Gestapo captured their chief, General Stefan Rawicki, Himmler felt they could be swung around to fight Stalin instead of the German occupation forces. Hitler read Rawicki's Vita and admitted that he had had the same idea, but he decided against it. Rawicki was obviously a leader, and such men were dangerous. Himmler noted, quote, "The Führer then reiterated the basis of our policies. These I was aware of and fully understand," end quote. Hitler had no such compunctions about using non-Slav soldiers. He particularly wanted to attract British captives into joining the fight. Huell had noted after a conversation with Hitler on November 29, 1942, quote, "He believes that countless patriotic Englishmen must be suffering under their present regime, as they see the future danger of the Jews and particularly the Bolsheviks taking over the empire. He considers it quite possible that given suitable treatment, a British legion could be raised to fight in British uniforms against Bolshevism. Such a legion would be more welcome to him than any one of any other nationality," end quote. Stalin's counteroffensive had begun north of the Operation Citadel, with Orel as its target. On July 13th, the Führer summoned both Army Group commanders Manstein and Kluge. Kluge favored calling off Citadel. Manstein, still brimming with optimism, took the opposite view. His armies were on the brink of victory. If he could add the 24th Panzer Corps to them, it would tilt the balance finally against the defenders of Kursk. The Russians had thrown their last reserves into the battle. He felt that he could still encircle and destroy half the troops defending Kursk. If the battle was tamely abandoned, the enemy would be free to cause trouble later elsewhere along the front. When Kluge declared that the 9th Army could not resume the attack, either now or later, Hitler irritably exclaimed, quote, "The Russians manage everything and we manage nothing at all," end quote. Thus the battle was stopped, neither defeat nor victory. Hitler had lost 20,720 men, including 3,330 dead. Quote, "That's the last time I will heed the advice of my general staff," he proclaimed to his adjutants. That's the end of the quote. But the Russians had suffered the heavier losses in Citadel. 17,000 dead and 34,000 prisoners. Their tactical reserves had been decimated. Accordingly, the next weeks were to see the Russian summer offensive faltering. When they launched a further attack on Manstein's southern front on July 17th, Mackensen's 1st Panzer Army and General Karl Hollitz's new 6th Army were able to beat them back, taking 18,000 prisoners and destroying 700 tanks in 2 weeks. When Stalin issued his order of the day on the 24th announcing his victory at Kursk, he claimed that 70,000 Germans had died and 2,800 German tanks had been destroyed. Hitler remarked, My feeling is, this proves he has called off his own show. Stalin has abandoned all hope of pushing on here in one big furioso." End quote. It seemed that stability had returned to the Russian front. In Sicily, however, there was crisis. The Italians were barely putting up the pretense of a fight. All the indications were that Mussolini's renegade generals and the king were plotting his overthrow. Why, otherwise, did Ambrosio now play the familiar Italian card of raising impossible demands for modern tanks and aircraft to be supplied forthwith by Germany? The American army readily mopped up the Italians in western Sicily, but the British 8th Army was soon held up by a tough, predominantly German-manned line of defense forward of Mount Etna. Mussolini attempted to push the blame for the inevitable loss of Sicily onto the Germans for having failed to meet Ambrosio's supply demands. On July 13th, 30 Italian torpedo boats did sally forth to attack enemy ships off Syracuse, but they returned unscathed, lamely pleading that they had not found any Allied shipping. Richthofen sneered in his diary, quote, "As expected, the Italian fleet has not even put to sea to save its honor." End quote. Dönitz telephoned Hitler's headquarters to say that if Hitler so commanded, he was willing to take over the Italian navy at once, so as to bring at least the loyal destroyers and submarines into action. Hitler was certainly minded to ride roughshod over Italian sovereignty. He sent a major to Sicily with a top-secret oral instruction that the German corps commander was to take over the battle himself, quote, unobtrusively excluding, unquote, Italians from control. A general commandant was also nominated for the Strait of Messina. The Italian batteries were to be manned by the German crews if need be. Dönitz eagerly supplied 1,723 naval gunners. On the 14th, the OKW brought its contingency plans for a lightning German action against Italy and the Italian-occupied Balkans up to date. On July 14th, Hitler showed Mussolini's letter, drafted by Ambrosio, demanding 2,000 aircraft to Field Marshal Milch. On the last 3 weeks, 320 Axis aircraft had been destroyed in attacks on Italian airfields. 36 fighters out of 40 had just suffered tire damage because the Italians had not bothered to sweep the runways clear of bomb fragments after a raid. Milch assured the Italian ambassador that, quote, the Führer could hardly have provided better air support for Germany than he is providing for Italy. Hundreds of aircraft are already on their way to Italy, and hundreds more are on their way at the expense of the night fighter defenses of our own western airspace, end quote. Jodl warned that it seemed that Ambrosio was plotting to lure as many elite German divisions as possible to the south, where they could be cut off and turned over to the enemy on a platter when the time came. Hitler had to get Mussolini to rid himself of General Ambrosio, his own appointed gravedigger, somehow. Dönitz asked that the Italian Admiralty also be frozen out, to reduce its present unholy influence on the campaign. Hitler decided to meet Mussolini again. Meanwhile, he picked General Hube, the veteran of Stalingrad, to command all ground troops in Sicily. Goering tried hard to get his own General Rainer Stahel appointed, but Rommel out-argued him. Hitler had intended giving Rommel overall command in Italy, but now Goering got his revenge. On July 18th, Rommel wrote in his diary, quote, At midday with the Fuhrer, I learned that the Fuhrer has been advised not to make me commander-in-chief in Italy, as I am supposed to be hostile toward the Italians. I assume the Luftwaffe is behind this. End quote. Two new army groups were now created. B, to be commanded by Rommel from Salonika, covering Greece, Crete, and the Aegean, and E, commanded by General Lohr from Belgrade to control the rest of the Balkans. In the event, Rommel's new appointment lasted just 1 week. The uncertainty about Italy gnawed literally at the pit of Hitler's stomach. Before flying south on July 18, 1943, in his personal FW-200 Condor, he sent urgently for Professor Morell at 10:30 a.m. The doctor wrote in his diary, quote, "Fuhrer says he's had the most violent stomach pains since 3 a.m. and hasn't slept a wink. His abdomen is as taut as a board, full of gas, looking very pale and exceptionally jumpy, facing a vital conference with the Duce in Italy tomorrow. Diagnosis: spastic constipation caused by overwork over the last few days. 3 days with virtually no sleep, one conference after another and working far into the night. As he can't duck out of some important conferences and decisions before his departure at 3:30 p.m., no narcotics can be given him. I can only give him an intravenous injection of one ampoule of Eupivirin, a morphine substitute. Some gentle stomach massage, 2 Euflat pills, and 3 spoonfuls of olive oil. Before leaving for the airfield, I give him an intramuscular Eucodal injection. He is looking very bad and feeling rather faint." End quote. Goering joined them in the plane and expressed his own medical advice on Morell. The Fuhrer should take more Euflat and Luizam tablets. Looking deathly, Hitler sat just behind the cockpit, his papers spread out on the folding table, meditating that it was all turning out just as he had feared. Quote, "This was precisely why I was so apprehensive about launching our offensive in the east," he would say a few days later. I kept thinking that at the same time we'd find our hands full in the south." End quote. Quote, "During the actual flight," Morell observed in his diary, "Hitler let off wind, which resulted in some improvement. Up at the Berghof, I gave him another body massage, with more Euflat, followed by the Luizam I have been giving him repeatedly for some time." End quote. Hitler retired for the night soon after midnight. Professor Morell woke him to administer the, quote, "injections as usual," end quote, at 6:30 a.m. the next day, July 19th. Quote, "His abdomen is supple. He has slept well and let off a lot of wind," end quote. The doctor thrust several of his own patent Vitamultin bars into Hitler's hands for the day's trip down to see Mussolini. Hitler took off at 7:30 a.m. for Treviso. His strategy now was this. Somehow, they must tempt the Allies to pour reinforcements into Sicily. Then the Luftwaffe would bomb the supply ships and starve the invader into submission. It would be Tunis in reverse. He had therefore resolved to confront Mussolini with a personal ultimatum. Sicily must be effectively defended with a view to reverting the offensive later on, or it should be abandoned, and the decisive battle fought on the Italian mainland. Mussolini probably wanted to impart to the Fuhrer that his country could no longer fight on. Hitler did not, however, give him a real opportunity to speak his mind. The account rendered in Mussolini's diary describes how things went from the moment Hitler arrived at the Treviso airfield. Quote, "Punctually, at 9, the Fuhrer landed. He inspected the guard of honor, and we proceeded to the station. After about an hour, the train left us at a station outside Feltre. An automobile bore us onward to the villa selected for our meeting, the house of Senator Gagia, a veritable labyrinth of rooms and salons which are still a nightmare in my memory. We arrived there after an hour's drive in an open car under a scorching sun, during which I merely exchanged polite small talk with the Fuhrer. The actual meeting began at noon. The Fuhrer began talking and continued for 2 hours. His words were taken down in shorthand, and the complete text of his speech is in foreign ministry files. Scarcely had he begun when my secretary came in with a telephone message from Rome. Quote, Since 11 a.m., Rome has been under intense air bombardment, unquote, I informed the Führer and the others. The news charged the atmosphere with tragedy. The atmosphere crowded in on us with each fresh telephone message reporting the exceptional length of the raid, the number of bombers employed, and the severe damage, including the university and the church of San Lorenzo. When the Führer had concluded his speech, a first confidential exchange of opinions took place between the two of us. He imparted two important facts to me. Firstly, the U-boat war was about to be resumed with other means. And secondly, at the end of August, the German Luftwaffe would begin reprisal attacks on London, razing it to the ground within a week. I replied that in anticipation of the reprisals, Italy's air defenses would have to be strengthened. I was then called away to receive fresh reports, whereupon it was time to return. Only during the hour-long train journey could I make one thing plain to him, that Italy is now withstanding the weight of two empires, Britain and the United States, and there is a very real and growing danger of her being crushed beneath them. The bombing of our cities damages not only our public's morale and powers of resistance, but also our main war production. I told him again that the campaign in Africa would have ended very differently had we been at least equal, if not superior, to the enemy air force. I also warned that the nervous tension within my country is now at an extreme and dangerous pitch. He told me the Italian crisis was a leadership crisis, and hence a human one. He would send reinforcements for the air force and new divisions to defend the peninsula. He declared that the defense of Italy is also in Germany's highest interests. His choice of words was friendly at all times, and we parted on the best of terms. The Führer's aircraft took off soon afterwards. End quote. Hitler was satisfied with the outcome of this, as it happened last, visit to Italy. He believed he had revitalized the Italian effort. His generals were unimpressed. Field Marshal von Richthofen wrote that day, quote, "At the villa, the Führer delivered a two-hour speech on how to fight wars and battles. Nobody, apart from the Duce, understood a word. Afterward, Ambrosio observed with a smirk that it was not so much a colloquio as a disloquio. The Führer was tired from so much energetic speaking, but looked well, much better than the Duce. The whole show has probably produced less than one could conceal under a little fingernail." End quote. Quote, "Back on the Ober-Salzburg this evening," recorded Hitler's doctor, "he declares that the credit for the day's success goes to me. He feels completely well again." End quote. That evening, July 19th, Martin Bormann showed to Hitler an intelligence report cabled by Himmler to the Berghof. It contained clear evidence that a coup d'etat is being planned to get rid of the Duce and install Marshal Badoglio to inform a war cabinet. Himmler's report said, quote, B is known to be a leading Freemason in Italy. His aim is said to be to commence immediate peace talks the moment the Anglo-American troops have completed their occupation of Sicily, end quote. There was no point in warning Mussolini. He was too naive. On the station, he had blurted out to Hitler, quote, "I just don't know why my generals are stationing such strong forces up here in the north," end quote. Shortly afterward, German railroad officials tipped off the OKW that the Italians were stockpiling ammunition in the fortifications facing the Reich. Hitler invited Rommel to his evening conference on July 20th. Quote, "His talk with the Duce yielded no real clear decisions," end quote, noted the field marshal. Quote, "Duce unable to act as he would wish. "I am to take command over Greece, including the islands, for the time being, so that I can pounce on Italy later," end quote. The next day he wrote, quote, "Morning conference. The Duce is aware of his colleagues' political intentions," end quote. On July 23rd, he flew off to begin his task in Greece. Here, apart from the questionable Italian 11th Army, he would command only one German panzer division and three German infantry divisions. On July 24th, storm cones were hoisted over southern Europe. News reached Hitler that the fascist Grand Council was meeting that evening for the first time in years. As midnight passed without word from Rome, Hitler grumbled that if a German had pulled a trick like that on him, he would have had Himmler haul him off straight away. Quote, "What good can possibly come of such a meeting? Just empty chatter." End quote. Before he retired for the night, a report reached him that the British had attacked Hamburg with 1,000 heavy bombers. Oh man, that's a big attack. The first photos were shown to him the next morning. Corpses littered the streets. Women with their hair in curlers, children seeking shelter in the arms of firefighters. In one parish alone, 800 had died. At his noon conference on the 25th, Hitler learned that the enemy had found a simple means of jamming the ground in airborne radar sets. Part of Hamburg's anti-aircraft batteries had been sacrificed for the defense of Italy anyway. Hitler steeled his heart. For the present, Rome was more important. He swung around on Huell. Quote, "See that you find out what you can." End quote. Huell replied, quote, "They adjourned their consiglio at 3 this morning. I'll find out the moment anything comes through." End quote. By the time the conference ended at 2 p.m., he could still report only that the wild rumors were sweeping Rome. Later that day, word came that Marshal Badoglio had asked the German ambassador to see him. Badoglio dropped his bombshell. Mussolini had resigned. The king had asked the marshal to set up a military government. That's the end of the chapter.